to hand over to Pierre. But I suppose before that, I think what is clear is that we do need clarity about what we need to present here, because, you know, the two issues, I would have been happy to present a plan, you know, on several, in fact, my last slide, but given the time and what we were told, we were, and this is a Q2 and Q3 presentation, but we went beyond that and looked at, so I think we have clarity, because there's a lot of plans being put in place in various parts of the organization to deal with several challenges. So I think that's really important. I do recall you did mention it at the last meeting, and we thought we'd just touch on it in the end, but various reasons. So I think that that's really important. But I'm going to hand over to Pierre now to start, and then we'll go through various colleagues who will take several questions, and then I'll look at what's left in the end.
Thank you. Thank you, NDPP. Thank you, Chair. I will start with the question raised by Honourable Member Horn in relation to the further rollout of Tutuzela Care Centres. Indeed so, you will recall from the last presentation that we've got 55 sites at present. We're in the position to identify and to establish an additional 6 from the CARA allocation that we received. Originally, the business plan provides and indicates to us that we need to implement 5, but we've actually targeted 6 additional sites. That's in various stages of being established. The deadline for it to be established is March 2021. Now, what it entails is also purchasing of park homes, because there's not necessarily sufficient space at all the hospital sites where these sites need to be established. That also includes positions to be created on the establishment. For instance, as you will recall, a site coordinator or site manager, a victim assistant officer, and then your experienced sexual offences prosecutor or case manager deal with that. That process has kick-started as well in relation to get all in place for the end of March 2021 next year. In addition to your second question, where you also ask what is the NPA doing to capacitate the sexual offences designated courts, obviously you're referring to Section 55A that has been recently promulgated and commenced accordingly. Yes, we're in the process to also create additional positions. We're in a discussion process for sexual offences specific prosecutors to be appointed at those designated courts. We're working with DOJ in line with the regulations that you recall were also promulgated on the 7th of February. We've done the directives and the draft directives from our side for the prosecutors so that they know what their responsibilities would entail in line with Section 55A. In addition, we've also advertised other vacant posts at TCCs, which will also filter into the possible places where these courts will be designated as well. Just on another point that I also need to reflect, you will also recall that we have so-called pure courts in the system that's dealing with 100% sexual offences. And at those courts, we're also looking to link those courts to these designated courts. Possibly these will be the ones that will be designated as a kickstart process. Thank you. The other question was from Honourable Member Nivode in relation to slide 23, if I'm not, or 25. It's in relation to the TCC finalized cases and sentencing, where I reflected, or where it was reflected in the presentation, at 25% of cases in which we had convictions where the offenders were sentenced by court to life or 20 years, which was 354 in the previous financial year, similar period, Q3, and it's now 340. What it actually entails is the percentage is 3.4% better, so it shows an improvement that in more of the cases we have improved or more severe sentences imposed by the court. But the reality is, and that's clearly why it's a lesser number, is because in general less cases were finalized in this period. But this is not only a position in relation to sexual offences, and this is one thing that we're looking at as a collective in NPA and JCPS, also to figure out why are there that issue with less cases being finalized. So that's one of the issues that we're currently looking into. Those were the questions that were directed to me, NDPP and Chair, so if there aren't any additional follow-up questions, I am done. Thank you. I'm done, NDPP.
Who's next? Colin?
Okay. I'd like to deal with the issue of the recruitment. What happened is we have a full project plan relating to our recruitment in the NPA. Posts have been advertised at every single division in the country. I mean, there's 900 posts. But they weren't all advertised at once, because initially we got only the money in the AE&E, and then we got the additional budget, because we had to have a carry-through amount. And when we got the additional allocation, we could actually then advertise. So it's been stages. So in the first stage that we advertised was on 11 October 2019, and it was 319 posts. So to also answer the other question of the other honourable member, not all posts were advertised because we didn't get enough money for all posts. So we had to prioritise. We have prioritised prosecutor posts and critical admin support to prosecutors. So we're in the regions we feel that the prosecutors will not be able to do their job without certain critical admin components, those posts we've also advertised. But administrative posts that we feel we might be able to continue to work without have been not advertised. And as we relook at the money, we can see whether we can advertise those posts. So the first advert was 390, and main focus was NPS and SECU. We advertised senior prosecutor posts, senior state advocate posts, state advocate posts, regional court control prosecutor posts, and all the lower court posts, if I can put it in that way. That was our first day. We had a full project plan, which I can make available to you, and the date of assumption of duty on that project plan, bearing in mind the fact that we went into December and we had SOCWA, etc., who closed, and other areas where we couldn't get the accreditation done, the date of assumption was 1 April of this year. In fact, we believe that we will make that deadline for that first 319. That was phase one. Then on phase two, we put the second advert out. 62 posts were advertised. That was for NPS, SECU, AFU, and witness protection, but only two for witness protection. Once again, prioritizing prosecution, because that's our core business. We needed to make sure that they were capacitated with the money we've got. All DPP officers, posts were advertised. Directors in corporate services was for spokespersons in the regions where we didn't have. And then, of course, asset forfeiture, our senior state advocates and our advocates. Once again, because asset forfeiture has not been able to deliver due to capacity constraints. So it was very important for us to focus on building that capacity. The due date for those was to finalize the interviews, and we hoped that we could get people appointed by 31 January. Coupled to that process, we also allowed contract appointments to be able to bolster as additional to the establishment individuals. Most of those appointments have been made, but it's not huge numbers. It's about 50-odd extra individuals that we could bring in, because people don't want to take a year contract. We can only give a year contract, but that's to help us short-term, quick, bring in capacity for us to help. So I can give you a full report telling you exactly which post, what division, and where we are. And as I say, it's a changing figure because every day we're processing them. So I can make a commitment to by Friday giving you a full report on exactly who has been appointed in what places. So to answer the other question of the Honourable Member relating to the 921 posts advertised, all of those 900 are in various steps within the process. But 155 had already been finalized. The others, I can tell you exactly where they are. Memos that are either by us or by the divisions, or SOCWA accreditation is still outstanding. Every single memo is being traced throughout the province, okay? Equity, in terms of our recruitment process, I think they can just maybe touch on that aspect on the shortlisting. Even within our shortlisting process, we look at equity. Before any appointment is made, and I can give you the race and the gender breakdown of every single current advert that we've appointed, we do not make any appointments of people if it doesn't fall within the equity profile and the targets of government in respect of each of those. So in terms of those individuals that have said that they have not been shortlisted and that black people are being sidelined, I can emphatically state that that is not correct. I sign a lot of those memos, and I can emphatically tell you that we are serious about the equity profile of our organization, and we are serious when we shortlist and when we interview and we make our appointments to ensure that that is happening. There are other reasons why people were not shortlisted. You must understand there are criteria that have to be, you have to be you have to meet. You have to make sure your CV correctly gives us the data that will enable us to shortlist you. So a lot of those individuals you are referring to have lodged grievances. They've been finalized. They've been dealt with. And we're dealing with each one of those aspects in detail. I can tell you, without going into the merits of each case, because that would be improper, that every single matter has been dealt with correctly and that there is no question whatsoever in the recruitment process of equity being skewed in favor of any certain group. We are very, very serious about this in the organization. As regards the other matter raised around the death of the prosecutor, I also don't feel it's right to go into the detail thereof. However, I do feel that I need to bring to your attention the fact that we have received a full report on that matter, and I can tell you that the facts have not been correctly reported in the media, and I think the NDPP can deal with that in more detail should you require to do so.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am. I would first like to deal with your first question, the Bobrov matter. In respect of the Bobrov matter, South Africa, we obtained a preservation order for the excess of 100 million that was in Israel bank account. The matter was opposed by the Bobrovs. We were successful in obtaining the forfeiture order. And once we obtained the preservation order, South Africa sent a letter of request to Israel to ensure that the money is kept safe in Israel, and they did so by registering South Africa's preservation order in Israel. So the money is in a bank account in Israel and is being kept safe. The Bobrovs then asked for leave to appeal the forfeiture order. On the 6th of February this year, the Bobrovs received leave to appeal. So we are awaiting the finalization of the appeal process, and if we are successful as the NPA, we will then send a letter of request to Israel to repatriate the money to South Africa. So, ma'am, the process is ongoing. It's in court, and progress is being made. Sir, on your question regarding the recoveries, it is correct, at the end of Q3 there were zero recoveries in respect of ACTT matters or matters involving in excess of 5 million. However, at the end of Q3, the AFU had recovered 181 million in all of its cases, which were inclusive of some corruption cases, but cases that were perhaps not on the ACTT list. That specific indicator refers to matters that are on the ACTT list that is being investigated as a task team and brought to finalization. There are various reasons for non-achievement of or no achievement of that target. And maybe if I can be allowed just to elaborate on a few of them. In a large number of matters, the AFU has obtained preservation orders or freezing orders in the matter. We can only then proceed to a final order once there is a conviction in our Chapter 5 matters. So many of those matters are in the process of the prosecution process. These processes take quite a number of years because these matters are generally very complex matters. So once the matters are finalized and we are successful, we will proceed with a confiscation order. And this indicator then also further refers to the process after the confiscation order, when the assets are sold, the curator's accounts are approved, and the money is actually paid over to victims and CARA. So there are a number of cases that's still going through the secondary process. And so we are hoping that the matters where we have the preservation and the restraint orders in place will eventually realize into confiscation orders, and then we can contribute significantly to this target.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. I will start with the question that related to slide number 19, the one that is a quota conviction. If I understood the question correctly, was why only the two accused? And I think I mentioned in that case that the reason why it is the only one that was picked up is because in the quota,
it was the only one that relates to a 5 million conviction. And then the two were basically the two accused who got convicted. I don't know if that satisfies. Okay. Thank you. Then the other question related to the trio crimes, slide 25, where I think the honorable member wanted to find out whether the issue or the difficulty of identification in hijackings is such a limitation that it can push the conviction so low. I think the honorable member asked whether is the suggestion being made here, maybe, that it is only identification that you can use in cases of car hijacking? And the answer is certainly no. I think the question of identification was probably singled out as one of the contributing factors in a pattern that we have observed over several trend analysis, that out of the trio crimes, car hijackings is the one with the lowest conviction rates. I can just give the member, for instance, and it's not as if the figures are very low. Yeah, I can just give, for instance, the breakdown for quarter three of the trio crimes. We had in-house robberies convictions in 225 cases, and we had acquittals in 32 cases. And then in business robberies, we had convictions in 94 cases and acquittals in 28. Then there is the issue with car hijackings. Out of the figures, cases finalized in quarter three, 87 were convictions and 105 were the acquittals, which then pushes the achievement on trio crimes low, but at least we are satisfied that in the most feared crime, which is house robberies, at least we are having satisfactory convictions there. If then I can go to the aspirant question. The honorable member referred to the 382 which will be recruited in 70 centers. And I think the member made an average comparison that at this rate it is going to be at least 5 per center. But I during the body break, I just spoke to my coordinator of this program, and I'm advised that the 382 has not been broken into equal numbers per center. The figures were discussed with the chief prosecutors to identify areas where they've got critical needs in terms of entry-level prosecutors. And the provinces that have requested aspirants is the Eastern Cape and Free State, Gauteng and KZN, Limpopo, Mpumalanga, Northwest and Western Cape. The other provinces that are not in this list therefore implies that the chief prosecutors there do not require any fresh intake. And the training, as I alluded to, these chief prosecutors have actually explained to their coordinator where these aspirants are going to be trained. So in each province, they are going to be trained where the chief prosecutor has identified the acute need. And another issue that I may want to mention in relation to aspirants, Chair and honorable members, is that we want to be careful about recruitment of aspirant prosecutors, in the sense that we certainly had the experience in the past that you do not want to train many prosecutors to the extent that you are not able to absorb them into the establishment. And they end up being excess capacity who end up being appointed on contract. And this has happened in the past. You would have a center with 10 aspirant prosecutors in a province, and they all successfully complete the program. But in that province, you only have got 3 vacancies, which means the 7 remain in the center, for lack of a better word, at excess capacity. So in this particular instance, the assessment has been made that upon completion, the aspirants will be absorbed. That is why you've got centers where, in fact, the chief prosecutors have said, I will not participate in this intake in this particular period, as I've just read the specific provinces concerned. Lastly, in relation to the question on the cybercrime, the member is correct that cyberspace is a very technical field, and you only need to see the cyber bill that is under consideration to realize that. And the cyber bill already makes provision for various levels of training which are required, and we are going to be the first one to accept that we are going to require this training as prosecutors. The bill identifies training, in fact, for policemen, for members of the intelligence community, even for the judiciary, because of the vast array of offenses that the new Cyber Act is going to create. Are there plans for that training? Certainly there are plans, Honorable Chair and Member, but the cyber environment is very, very complicated in terms of this bill. And I don't need to tell the Chair about the complications, whether it should be one bill or should be split. The discussions are happening. But the realization is that at least the enforcement part, or the part of the bill that creates offenses, is more urgent, and training should definitely follow that, because it would be undesirable and untenable to create or to promulgate a new act that creates several offenses and people are not ready to follow through. So to answer the member, Honorable Member, in direct terms, I'm sure a training program will certainly follow, or even have to be fast-tracked before the Cyber Act is promulgated. I think that's all for me, NTPP.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I want to say up front that I think there is a mismatch between the expectations of the committee and what I came to present on. And I think the best way to remedy that problem is to allow the ID to give a full report to the committee on the establishment of the ID, and then even on some of the matters that were raised by members. So I would undertake to do that by Monday, but I will address some of the questions as I see them, but it's not possible to fully brief the committee without giving you a full report. But the questions come in sort of three clusters. The one is capacitating the ID with people, and each of the members had questions relating to that. And in my presentation, which I accept was a narrative because I didn't know how else in the time available to share all the data, I thought, let me highlight key aspects. I will put to the committee our full establishment and how the ID is being capacitated. But to answer some of the questions in relation to our capacity, the first question from the Honorable Breitenbach about why are we letting competent, experienced personnel leave the NPA, we have advertised to appoint people on contracts for 3 years. We obtained a deviation from the Department of Public Service and Administration to permit that. And the idea there is we can recruit even retired people. And we have one or two retired people that we have interviewed and going through the process of finalizing the appointment, because we recognize that the experience that there is critical. But I think the thing that we also recognize is that there isn't a lot of experience with the kind of work that we are called upon to do. We are, in the last 10 years, haven't done that many serious corruption prosecutions. I would even say serious commercial crime prosecutions. And Advocate Bredenbach may differ with me on that, but, you know, traveling around the world, looking at how countries are addressing the challenges that they all face. We're not the only country that faces the challenges that technology has introduced in the prosecution of crime. The you know, international bodies are sitting down and saying, we are way behind as law enforcement around the world in trying to keep up with the pace of development. And there are key strategies that are being employed around the world that we are only beginning to employ in South Africa. So while there is experience that is leaving, the same in the police. There are experienced policemen who are leaving, but when a policeman is experienced with taking a bank statement with his ruler and underlining the key transactions, that is not going to help us going forward. We need in the police analysts who can write code, who can look through big data to find the information. So I'm just saying that I recognize that we mustn't lose the experience that we've had, but we must also recognize that for a lot of the issues we're dealing with, we actually don't have experience and we need to find other ways. That is why, as the Honorable Member Horn was saying, there are people in the private sector, there are consultants who we can bring in. But of course, and in that area we have asked Treasury for a deviation also to appoint that kind of expertise. Because a real problem, Honorable JLF, for example, in one of the ESCOM cases that we've taken to court, sorry, one of the Transnet cases we've caught, the regiments matter, the data that we have to analyze in that matter, and let me just say before I tell you about the data, it's not like we haven't done anything. We have a billion rand preservation order in place, a restraint order, in fact, in place in the regiments matter. 500 million of that has gone back to the Transnet second defined benefit fund with our assistance. We are now before court in that matter to increase the value of that order to 1.5 billion because as we go through the data, we find more payments that left, in this case, Transnet to regiments, and we have to adjust and adapt. You know, and it's through mining the data that we're finding this evidence. There's no other way to find this evidence. But in order to convict people for stealing that money that we are finding through the data, we need admissible evidence in court. And the admissible evidence is going to come from email communication and cell phone communication. So the evidence points to a meeting that happened between three people or four people or a decision taken. We need the capability to geolocate all of their cell phones in that area. And my boss is scared I'm going to give too much away about tactics, which is always the challenge with coming to account. Sorry? I know. And, you know, certainly the criminals know this. They know that this is what they must avoid, so they also have meetings and put their cell phones in Faraday bags. You know, they have ways of cleaning their computers without any trace. You know, there's advanced technology. Even if you clean your computer, you can access the data, But criminals are ahead of us. They know that. They have access to the technology to wipe clean. So when you ask, you know, what are you spending money on, I think we must give you a proper full report, but some of the capabilities, basic capabilities we think we require is to put all bank statements into a searchable database and intelligently search those databases and extract the evidence that we need. That is the kind of capability you would have assumed we were moving towards in the digital economy, but my colleagues are weary that I say that we don't have that capacity in the system. The Zondo Commission certainly have developed some of this capacity, so they are a year or 2 years ahead of us in sorting this out, so that's why we are in discussions with them about how to make the capability available to us. But they're still working, and so they also still need the capability. So if we are going to share the capability, we need a legal framework within which we share, because we can't necessarily see what data they've collected, and they can't necessarily see or have access to the data we've collected, and so we have to build Chinese walls between the data sets. But I think we owe you a plan. I think that that's fair for us to account for the money that we have been given and what it is that we've done with that money. I think the last question on investigators was why part-time investigators? The truth of the matter is that the ID is not a permanent organization, as the Honorable Breitenbach points out. What the ID is supposed to be is a capability that internationally is recognized as the kind of capability you need to investigate these kinds of cases. It is about bringing people together from different disciplines, different skill sets, different government departments, and then internationally across borders. And that's not an easy thing to do. It's hard enough just to get a team of your own people working on a particular focus issue. Trying to bring people from, you know, I have SARS investigators who have a particular culture in SARS. I have Financial Intelligence Center people who come from that culture. Then I've got police officers. Now, on the permanence of the police officers who are seconded to the ID, some of them are police officers who have been working on these cases for some time. They are witnesses in these cases, so I can't just say thanks but no thanks. They've gathered the evidence, they've kept the chain of evidence intact, so I'm dependent on them. But the same investigators have also done that work in other cases, and if I pull them off those cases, they collapse and the NDPP has to account for why cases. The same goes for some of the prosecutors. You know, I've recruited some of the best prosecutors, I think, in the NPA, but the best people are in demand across the system. So I had one prosecutor the other day coming from the Free State that we have put on a particular case, and there was an outcry in the province by the police, by the politicians, saying, how can you at this critical juncture pull this person out? And it's about saying, well, your priority versus my priority. Advocate Breitenbach, honorable member, says that the problem is the impermanence of the ID, the short-term nature. My view on that is it is very difficult to capacitate a short-term operation. But we don't actually have an alternative. It is critical to be able to develop a framework for people to come and go. You know, if you're a skilled engineer and you can give us evidence on a calculation of a variation contract that was crooked, we need that skill from you. We don't need it forever. We don't need it to recruit you on a permanent basis. We need you for 3 weeks, maybe. So we do need to develop a capability where people can come and go, but the framework that governs how they come and go needs to be very strong. This is a challenge internationally. And I think it's a challenge that we are putting the building blocks in place to meet. But we are going to make mistakes. It's not that easy. And we have to push and pull with our partners all the time. So the information sharing that is required is, I'll finish in a moment. But I did want to move off the people issue and just talk about the opportunity to account on what we have been doing. You know, the clamor in the media is for when are the heads going to roll? And that is a very difficult clamor to respond to. So I'm very grateful for the inputs from members saying, account to us in this way so that we can see that there is development. So I appreciate the analogy of wearing your pregnancy with pride, right? You know, showing the world that this capability that we are building is worth the time and the investment that we are putting into it, and it will yield the results. Instead, you know, we've been able to do is in our freeze is say, it's coming, it's coming. So I welcome, Chair, the opportunity to put on the table what birthing processes have happened in the 9 months. The challenge is always talking about cases and keeping out of the public domain our strategies and our the progress, but we I think must find a way to meet both sides. I do want to answer the question about treaties and how we are managing our international cooperation, because I do, that is a big issue for us. The Honourable JLA asked specifically, for example, on the Estina matter. You know, people deserve finality. They deserve to know, are they going to be accused or are they not going to be accused? And in November last year, I indicated that where we were with that investigation is an independent forensic report was commissioned to analyze all the data that we had collected, the financial data of money flows. And we received the report at the end of November. And what it crystallized is a decision needs to be taken in terms of whether or not we're getting evidence from abroad. The actual bank statements that we have unofficially, whether we go to court without them, because we are not going to get the international cooperation that we've been looking for 2 years in this matter, and cut our losses and say, going forward, this is the best evidence that we can adduce of what happened in this case. So what we've done is we have communicated to the executive. We do not have extraterritorial jurisdiction. Our only option is to say we either are or are not going to get the evidence and do and deal with the fact that the evidence is not there and move on. That will leave some people unaccounted for. Some people who benefited will get the benefit of the lack of international cooperation on this issue. So that is why we've escalated it to the executive, and we have said, we need a final answer on this. We are ready to go to court. We have two indictments, one with the information, one without the evidence. Sorry, one with the evidence and one without the evidence. We can't wait forever. We're going to move. So we have given an ultimatum for when we will go to court on that one. So on the treaty, there are treaties in place. Treaties have to be enforced in both jurisdictions, and that's our problem, that while we have a treaty, some countries are not honoring the obligations they undertook in those treaties in their countries, and it's hard to deal with it. So that's
Just on the treaties, I can add that when we were at UNCAC in December with the minister, our minister made a very, very hard-hitting statement against countries that were not prepared to honor their obligations in terms of treaties. But even though you may have bilaterals with countries, you don't need those. We have UNCAC, which actually places an obligation on countries to cooperate with each other. People often use, countries use treaties as an excuse. You don't actually need it. It helps. It's another step. But the fact that you have multilateral conventions are, you know, compel countries to, but countries that want to find excuses to cooperate will, as we are finding out with
a couple of them. So I'm going to deal with the remainder. I hope I cover all of them. If I don't, please remind me, or we will respond in writing. But Honorable Janji, I suppose I'll start with the first one with regard to the allegations by staff members. And look, these allegations, they are, you know, it's difficult because these are my staff. You know, so I feel I really don't want to talk about issues that I'm trying to deal with, but it's important, I think, I suppose, to this committee, and this is publicly broadcast. I've got to be careful about what I say because it's an important issue that we indicated that we are take very seriously and we're trying to deal with. But if there are any, you know, when you have discriminatory actions, it's because of discriminatory thoughts that start off. Every thought leads to an action. You can't act without a thought. I have never had a discriminatory mindset, ever, and I want to put that up. But if anyone has any evidence that I have discriminated in any way, then please put it on the table. And I know these allegations of racism, I've said it, it's going to come hard and fast against me personally and many other allegations. Let's deal with it, address it, and, you know, you be the judge at the end of the day. But these are, you know, these complaints, in fact, strangely, it was barely a month or two after I took office that these complaints came really, really hard against a new national director who was still trying to understand what was going on. And I thought, if these are historic, you know, was it raised with previous national directors? Why did it happen as soon as I took office? But we're dealing with it there. As the head of the organization, I have to, you know, deal with it in an objective manner, which is what we're doing. So we are seeking to appoint, and I've discussed this with the minister, he's aware of it, we are in the process of appointing a person. We had someone that for various reasons could not do this particular, because the process is quite advanced. So now we are going to try to fast-track that process and find somebody with the right skills and profile to ensure that this matter is properly, that there's a proper fact-finding, it's looked into it, and, you know, whatever outcomes, you know, we must deal with it as an organization because it's not good to have this cloud hanging. You need to kind of address it, get the facts, and deal with the matter. So we are dealing with that. And the issue of the appointment of Advocate Bell, again, you know, I don't like, this is a public broadcast, but I just want to say that Advocate Nicolette Bell is a black woman. She is has been in the DPP's office since 2004. She is a woman, and you did compare it to another staff member, which is also unfortunate, but my information is that he has 1 year less experience, but it's about various factors, you know. I mean, she's a black woman, she's a colored woman, there's no acting DPPs with that profile. She has been working responsible for operations in the DPP's office, acquitted herself really well. She also has regular interaction with stakeholders, with the judge president, and understand this is an acting position. It is not a permanent appointment. There are several DPPs that are several acting DPP positions, and I'm now dealing with a question that was raised by other honourable members about the acting positions. Some of these we cannot fill because it's a subject of litigation, so that ties our hands in that regard. But with those acting positions, I have asked Advocate Mzinyati, when he was acting head of NPS, now it's Advocate de Kock, to look at all of these positions and to look at a rotation. So you want to have continuity because they are very serious, senior positions, but at the same time you want to expose other staff members to these acting positions so that you can also assess the capabilities of different people when you do want to make the permanent positions. You have a better sense and people are not unfairly disadvantaged in this process. So we are trying to manage that in that way. With regard to, we recognize what all members that have talked about the acting positions. I'd like to assure the committee that we have changed certain acting positions, and I can assure the committee that those staff members that are acting in these positions are not there just to keep the seat warm. They, even though they know that, I mean, Advocate Mzinyati is doing it, Advocate de Kock has come on board and he's hit the road running and taken up from where Advocate Mzinyati has left off. They know that there are things that have to be done whilst they're there. And in terms of plans, processes, what are we doing, enhancing efficiencies, and it's all, you know, so it's
to really rest assure you that it's not people just sitting there thinking, I've just got to pull time here, you know, and then when I'm the stint is over, that's the end of it. They are certainly committed, you know, and think that's what's good about. We do have a lot of, I mean, Advocate Kok has come up from Cape Town at considerable personal sacrifice and without any DST, S&T claims, and other staff members have done it as well, simply because they say, we want to be part of rebuilding this organization, and we have to help the organization. So I think we're very fortunate that we have these kind, the caliber of these people in the organization that are prepared to do that. With regard to the deputy nationals, I talked about it earlier, I won't repeat that. Hopefully there will be appointments fairly soon. There are some DP, special director positions that we can fill because they're not the subject of litigation. And we're looking to fast track, and that would be the SCCU position, which was special director, which was held by Advocate Mhwebi, the special director for the asset forfeiture unit, and the DPP in the Free State. And so those appointments will be fast tracked as well. And then with regard to the issues that have been raised, firstly I'll deal with Honorable Breitenbach. Size of the delegation, yes, I think in the past, you know, we have been, you know, all kinds of questions. Were, so now that we know, given this, you know, after your strategy as well, that there will be a focus, we know what the focus is, we come with a very small, lean and mean delegation, and the questions we can't take because of detail, we will then deal with it at a later stage in writing. I've dealt with the acting appointments. The expertise, we're losing, Hermine has dealt with it, but, you know, Advocate Breitenbach has mentioned, we are looking to actually utilize some of the expertise. I don't want to mention names in this, but we are looking, some of the staff would mess, that have left, we are looking to see how we could actually utilize them, bringing them back in terms of mentorship or, you know, the training. We're trying to put up a you know, staff development is a big part of what is of strengthening the NPA, so we're looking to utilize people that have left in this process as well. The issue of the LP10 was raised. Look, the legal arguments are all in our papers, which are public. So I want to assure Advocate Breitenbach, this was one of the most difficult decisions I had to make when I came in as a national director, because the last thing I wanted to be is to be involved in litigation with senior members of the NPA. And I've communicated this to them as well via an NDPP brief, which is a communication that goes out to all staff, to explain why I had to do this. So, you know, it is a most, and some of them, I'm not going to point them out, but I have colleagues here that are sitting right here that are affected by this. And I know that they're not demotivated. So I'm not saying people are different, okay? And so, of course, it's money involved. People will be, you know, possibly be demotivated. And I believe lots of money. So, but that's not the reason why the decision was made to take this on appeal. We fundamentally believe that that decision is incorrect. The implementation of the LP10, I was a DPP years ago when this process was put in place. And there was a certain requirements in terms of how this LP10 is implemented. And those requirements have not been met. And so in our view, the legal arguments are all in the papers. In our view, I want to implement LP10, but it must be implemented in the correct way. And every opportunity I've had to speak to the senior members of the NPA that are affected, in my first 9 months, I also traveled around the country, driving sometimes more than 1,000 Ks in 2 days to visit staff in various parts, various divisions, but even in the low-lying courts. And talking to DPPs, deputy DPPs, chief prosecutors, explaining to them personally why I took this decision, because it's not about money, it's purely on the law and implementation of the LP10 the way it was intended to. But aside of that, you see, one of the issues, the cost of living increase, and I don't want to go into too much of detail, but just to say that has also exacerbated the position where senior members of staff, those at the DPP and deputy DPP and chiefs, are now earning less than those that they are supervising.
Now, that is an extremely unhealthy state of affairs in any organization. So just 2 weeks ago, I sat down with HR and said to them, well, we had the meeting, but I had even long before that said to them, look at how we can try to address this position so that we deal with the salaries of the deputies and the chiefs. But understand, the country is also in a financial crisis. You know, so here we are trying to address this. And I'm acutely aware that, so we cannot, and the financial impact of the LP10, it's not the reason why we, but it's something that we cannot ignore, that it's going to have huge financial costs, not just to the NPA, because the litigation is in the NPA, but this is going to be across government, because they are legally trained practitioners in various government departments. And we had to ensure that this LP10 implementation is done responsibly, it's done in a legally sound way, and that we ensure that we comply with all the requirements that were set out when the OSD was initially introduced. So I'm hoping that staff members that are listening to me, the very experienced ones, know and understand that we need their expertise. I'm here to look after them as well, and that we need to pull together on this one. So that's on the LP10. The 5 million as a measure came out. I agree with you, that's pocket money in today's, but that's an old target of, you know, and so we, that's going to, it's in the next, in the new plan that we, that's out of there. We're looking at how to rephrase it, I'm not sure, but that's an old target that we still locked into for now. It's very sad that we think 5 million is just pocket money today, but that's the reality.
Don't be distracted.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I appreciate
with,
that.
You are left with a few minutes.
Can I just then ask honourable members to please behave themselves? So let me get back to, let me just gather my thoughts. So conviction rates, I dealt with it. And in future, if we give narrative, we will give you, staff members here will tell you, I say to them, don't give me these figures here. I want to know what's the story that those figures are telling. What is the analysis? And Advocate Mzinyati has been tasked to go look into the asset forfeiture over the past 5 years. See, what exactly, because sometimes we get one or two big cases, it hits the target. But what else is everybody else doing? So, you know, enhancing efficiency in that space is something we're going to look at. TRC cases, it was dealt with, but I want to emphasize that this is a really, it's a priority. It's not a priority just because these matters are now before court. When I took office, that was already put on the agenda as something we need to deal with in terms of how we address the deaths in detention, etc., which I won't repeat what Advocate Mzinyati said. But what I will say is that just about October or last year sometime, we met with civil society, academics, lawyers representing the family, basically to look at how can we think about prosecuting apartheid as a crime against humanity. How can we really try to hold those most responsible? So these conversations and discussions at a very, you know, academic level are being considered so that we as prosecutors are starting to think about utilizing international law in terms of holding responsible, accountable those most responsible for atrocities committed during the apartheid era. With regard to the rogue unit cases, what I will say is that I issued a press release at the time explaining why these charges were withdrawn. The bottom line is that there were no reasonable prospects of a successful prosecution. And I don't want to go into detail because I have been the case is now under review because a political party has written to me, and it is a subject of review. And then in due course, the all of this will come out. But I'd be very pleased when it does, because I would really like people to know, you know, why this decision was overturned and why, in the view of the panel, which I agreed with, it was the incorrect decision. And just to allay your fears as well, this is not an external panel. These were prosecutors in-house, Advocate Barry Madola, the DPP in Mthatha, Advocate Indra Gobardhan, who was the acting DPP in Grahamstown,
and Advocate Adrian Mopp, who was a deputy DPP, very senior in the Cape Town office, were the three members of the panel. And then, those were dealt with, GTs. The ACTT. Look, Advocate Libya chairs that, and I have a lot of respect for Advocate Libya. He's, you know, I believe he's really trying his damnedest. I think pretty much I can empathize with him because he's in a similar situation to where I am, trying to rebuild an institution without capacity, without capabilities, and with serious skills, and if you add to that corruption and integrity issues, it becomes very, very difficult in those circumstances. The ACTT, we know what happened, and we are in the ACTT. I am a member of the ACTT. I'm meant to be, according to a document, the co-chair, but it doesn't really work like that in practice. Advocate Libya, you know, he chairs the sessions. But I think, you know, we recognize with the ACTT, perhaps I should contextualize, is a substructure of the JCPS. And so at the JCPS level, we have recognized that it's not working, that people don't feel safe, and that is, we had Honorable Wilma Drucken, I hope I pronounced that properly, mentioned, you know, what are we doing about gun violence at that level, and, you know, if people still don't feel safe, then we are not achieving those high-level outcomes that the JCPS wants to. And there's a recognition. I mean, I've been here, yes, for 1 year, but in my early days, I was very, very vocal about the fact that things are not working. But now you've got to find solutions. You've got to be part of the solutions. We can't be complaining about things. We have to have plans about what are we going to do to address it. So the JCPS retreat, which was scheduled for 9, 10, 11, somewhere around there in March, we have put on the agenda, including with the National Commissioner, who chairs that jointly with the Minister of Defense or the Secretary of Defense, have to look at very critically the efficiency of the JCPS. Why is it as efficient? Why are we not achieving our outcomes? What should, perhaps at a political level, you know, the President or someone at that level should be saying, do we need to really have some kind of reform of this? Not just the JCPS, the entire cluster system, how do we look at it? But from the operational perspective, we are having a meeting to say, how do we actually make sure, is it structured properly? Because the substructures of the JCPS are the ACTT, it's the NAT joints, and the DEVCOM. NAT joints being the operational arm, DEVCOM being the policy arm. And the NAT joints, we said part of this retreat should look at, are these structures working efficiently? How are they structured? What is the mandate? What are the, not just meetings, but how are things decided in these meetings? So I'm going to leave it at that because I can see time. But just to let you know that perhaps we can send you more feedback on that. But in the ACTT space, there's the National Crime Prevention Strategy. There's a reference group with civil society as well that are part of that to assist in how we could actually ensure that implementation of that happens. I'm just going to flick through to say, and I can certainly advise, inform the Honourable Horn, we are not here to say, well done, we did one case. That is not the approach we take. We certainly have a lot more to do, and we are certainly not at the moment saying we're doing very well, but there's a lot that needs to be done. And one day, very soon, hopefully, we'll say, well done, we are getting there, but not quite yet. On the prisons and the overcrowding and the entire system, you know, I can speak on that for 15 minutes. Yes, high levels. We want the people to go to jail. The prisons can't cope with it. But what we've realized is that we need to be prosecuting smartly and strategically. Are we filling our prisons with the right people? You know, and that's the question that the JCPS must look at. So we are looking at this IPSO Innovation Policy and Support Office. We're looking at international best practices with smart prosecutions and together with our colleagues, particularly in SAPS, to look at how can we actually be more strategic so that the right people are in prison and we are making an impact on crime at the end of the day, which we aren't at the moment. Low-hanging fruits was mentioned. We are aware of that. There are a number of cases, the municipal cases are certainly some of them, but
there's a lot going on in the space outside of the directorate that I think we need to communicate more, which people are not aware of, and we're certainly going to be working on that. And at the end, I just want to, Honorable Wilma Drucken mentioned about the gun violence issue. I will take it up in the JCPS and see what collectively, we can do about this. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Now, please, Honorable Nevo Drakens, please. There are many
Thank
people
you.
That are... Hello, sorry. Please, just listen to my summary. There are other people I've suppressed. We have quite a number of issues that we still need to deal with. We still have to deal with the magistrates' issues. There's still quite a number of issues that we need to deal with. Thank you very much to the National Director and to your team. What is quite clear is that we need to deal with expectation gaps amongst ourselves, between the committee and yourselves, between yourselves and society. Because I was just saying to Honorable Janji, part of the problem, you are a victim of your own PR. Now, people's expectations are high because of what you have promised them. Now there is a year of orange overalls and all of those things. And I said to Advocate Batui, my worst fear is a repeat of the Magnus Malan situation, where prosecutors prosecute without enough evidence and people are acquitted. The backlash that we will get as a nation, and in particular the NDPP. But I think it's important that we need to have this kind of a 2-3 day workshop to manage some of these issues amongst ourselves. There is I think the issue raised by Advocate Breitenbach, I think it's important. We need to really have a common understanding about the future of the independent directorate. We do need to have a common understanding. Given all what we know, most of your cases, by the time the 5 years end, maybe they will be starting or about to start. But we really do need to have that kind of an understanding. The issues relating to that roadmap that we promised, I think it would be important that it is discussed in a much more detail in that kind of a workshop, 2-3 day kind of a workshop, where we can explore some of these matters in a much more detail. For instance, when we were in the Department of Public Enterprises, one of the issues that we did to ensure that we assist in math and science, it was the use of telematics. It is based in Stellenbosch, where you can have all the prosecutors, where you have the telematics, where the lecturers are in Stellenbosch, but they can be, it's televised, it's broadcasted live, national, wherever. So these are some of the issues that we can try and explore as part of what we need to do. The other problem with regard to Medupi and Kusile, one of the findings was that the Chinese will spend 5 years planning how to build a power station, and then they build it within 3 years, and then we spent 6 months and then as a result, the build program is more than 15 years, but the planning was not enough. So we have to go back to some of that. That is why I think it was important the issue raised by Honorable Janji of the roadmap. We must really look at, is the planning the right planning? Is it the right planning by all of us to ensure that we don't plan for a few days and make mistakes for the whole 5 years? So we have to manage this public pressure. The PR is such that now there's an expectation that this is the year of the orange overalls. But we might not have this capacity from what I hear. And once we don't have these people in orange overalls, it undermines the whole PR again. It's not only you, quite a lot, many of us have talked about this orange overalls. I know that the NDVP says that she is never, but what she can't deny is that the whole country is gripped by this year of orange overalls. I'm quite concerned also there is the issue raised by Honorable Jelle about people like Bobrov. I mean, when I grew up in Watville, it was in the 90s, we knew that Bobrov is a crook. There are people that he stole monies from. Most of them have died. We have just received a briefing last week about lawyers who are stealing money from the state attorneys. There are courts that, in fact, a budget for those courts was 3 billion. For 6 courts, only 3 have been built at 6 billion. And these are the things that, as a committee, also we'd want a better coordination between the SIU and yourselves and the Hawks. But I think it would be important that we have that kind of a 3-day workshop so that we can deal with all of these issues so that we can be have one expectation at least. You carry this baby with pride for 9 months. I think it would be important that we are together. Also, we raised this matter in the workshop where you have advocates, senior counsels who have been this status was bestowed on them by the state, senior counsel, and others are junior seniors. But to what an extent are they? But it is most of these people, when they talk about fighting corruption, but I think we need some of them to come and work pro bono to deal some of these cases, some of these experiences. It can't be that government is only good when it pays. And some of them are highly trained. Honorable Horn was talking about skills in the private sector. They are the private sector. So we really need to engage much more broadly our stakeholders to ensure that where there is a lack of resources, how do we augment with patriotism for the country, people coming to assist us to build this country. Honorable Janji, next week the JPS, I'm told, is meeting, so we'll raise some of these issues. The committee, it's meeting. But we'll have a date where we would not be constrained by time, where Advocate Mzinyati can speak at least half a day explaining some of these issues, but I think we would organize that. As our whip had questions, Honorable Velma had questions, but I think in that workshop we'll be able to deal with some of these issues. and then you can bring some of those people that were not in the meeting, so that at the end of that workshop, we must all have one, we must all sing from one script. Thank you very much.
Request, Chair, that we get sufficient notice of the date of the workshop and also indication of what is expected of the NPA, so that we come there well prepared for a very constructive engagement.
No, we will do that. I think because we are changing the approach, I think also on our side there are deficiencies, but we are working to ensure that the new system works better for everybody. Thank you very much.